Okay, I want to begin everyone. It's already after 9 o'clock. First, before we get back to where we were, just to cover a couple things first, I want to thank Yecheskel Moskowitz, who a number of you might recall that I had mentioned those big kippot, the East European kippot, that I had never seen them. Well, he sent me one from Jerusalem. Here it is. This is what you've seen. Rav Moshe Feinstein used to wear, Rav David Lifshitz, Rav Unterman. So I thought I would wear this maybe for Purim. Thank you, Yecheskel, for that. But then on Shabbos, I was a scholar in residence in the shul, and I found something else that I think I'm going to wear for Purim. Check it out. Make shul great again. I think I'll give my father a heart attack, I think I'll wear it for fun. Okay, a couple things from one more thing before we get going. Rabbi Sam Thurgood, who's from Cape Town, he's never listens live. He listens on the tapes. In fact, he's listened to every single class we've ever done, all 175, and he tells me he's listened to them more than once. And I told him the other day that we're thinking all of us are thinking about Cape Town, which is going to run out of water very soon. But he was listening to an older tape, and it's good that we're getting close to Pesach, because I spoke about the practice of how it developed in America, that the OU doesn't give hashkacha anymore to peanuts and that peanut oil, and how the OU used to, and the response of Moshe Feinstein. And he pointed out to me the following, that in South Africa, they still do. And look what he sent me. Because remember, I told you that in Lithuania, they always ate peanuts on Pesach. This comes from, he sent it to me from, this is under the Ashkacha, you see, of the Cape Town based in. This is from, it's actually 2 years ago, 2016. But as you can see, it's peanuts. And my suggestion was, since Rav Moshe Feinstein says that if you have the minhag, that is, if you're from Lithuania, if you have the minhag to eat peanuts, you can continue eating peanuts, that maybe people on Pesach should make a practice of giving their family peanuts so that they have the minhag. Because the problem with a lot of these hashkachas is if you can't eat it anymore, then all of a sudden it's no longer your minhag, you can make the claim. So here is peanuts from Cape Town, not regarded as kitnios. Okay. A couple other things. We ended the last class dealing with the practice of, we were dealing with standing up for the Aseres Hadibros. And a couple things on that. First, Moshe from Lakewood pointed out, and this got us into a discussion, that he made a mistake, and I accepted what he said because I didn't know. He said that Rav Zalman Sender Shapiro was the son of Rav Label Kovner, Label Shapiro, and that's not true. It's Rafal Shapiro, he says, is the son, Rav Chaim Soloveitchik's father-in-law. Okay, so that's a correction. I wasn't sure myself, but Moshe from Lakewood usually knows everything, so I accepted that. Now, he also says to me, he's not very happy with the different explanations, justifications for standing up for the Aseres Hadibros. So let me say, first of all, that in last week's Parsha Sheet of Rav Mazuz, he presents more justifications for standing up and for the Ten Commandments, including that the biblical verse itself says, the Yidyatzfu B'tachtis HaTahar, Shemos 19, verse 17, says that they were standing up. And you can read all the explanations there. As well as I mentioned, Rav Avad Yosef, some people asked me about this. Well, it's in volume 1 of Yechaved Da'at, number 28. But he also has a responsum in volume 6, number 8, which begins, if you're in a shul which does stand for the Aseret Hadibrot, which he says is forbidden, what are you supposed to do then? And in this responsum, that's where he quotes from Label Kovner. That's where I got it from. And he also says that, so he concludes that while it's forbidden, if you're in such a shul, don't sit down as you're supposed to with everyone is, instead stand up best from the beginning of the Torah reading or from the beginning of the Aliyah. He also quotes in here Ramosha Feinstein's point that there's no problem standing up, and he rejects it. So incidentally, in this response and in the other one, he says that the Rambam's Tshuva that we spoke about, first published in 1934, is mentioned by Rav Yaakov Castro, which goes back a few hundred years ago in the response of Ohr Yaakov. I mentioned that as well. If you look at the response, however, what you see is he doesn't mention the part about the Aseret HaDibrot. He mentions other things in the responsum, but not that. And we did not know about that till 1934. What he mentions there is that the Rambam in that responsum says that the Karaites, the contemporary Karaites, are not the ones that the Talmud refers to as the Minim. Some people didn't know who the Karaites were. Okay. And we spoke about making of a Gadol last class. We'll continue more about that when we start. I just want to mention, I was asked by Meiselman, who's with us, the New York Times article I spoke about. Here it is. It's from, you just Google Rabbi, just Google Nathan Kamenetsky, making of a Gadol. It's the title of the book is Rabbis Who Were Sages, Not Saints. It's not such a good title because, I guess it's maybe rabbis who were sages, but were not perfect or something like that. I don't know if it's such a good title, but he mentions right at the beginning that even as these rabbis show remarkable analytic powers, they read Tolstoy, they have relatives tempted by communism, they write love letters to their fiancés. That's referring to what we saw last week, Rav Aaron Cutler. He writes plural here. They write love letters. It's only one individual, but and we saw last week, and I'll get to the comments towards the end. We saw last week that my argument that there's no way to read this passage, in my opinion, other than it being a love letter. I also made a mistake because I said that in the so-called improved edition, it didn't mention that the Alter said about Rav Aaron that I did not tell you he was a tzaddik. Actually, it did say that. It changed the next sentence about the Frumkite. Here is the edition I told you about, the improved edition. But notice in the original edition, no one has pointed out what I'm going to show you now. As far as I know, on the Sfarim blog years ago, they had a whole list of changes, but they didn't point out this change. Here is the first edition, and there is, as I showed you, Rav Aaron Cutler. Now look at the improved edition. Rav Aaron Cutler's face is taken out. Again, so you should dress like this. But for whatever reason, he chose to take it out. Okay. Let us pick up. I will get to the comments and everything, like as always, about 10 minutes till we're done. We ended last class how the yeshiva, how the communists took over. And it became very difficult in Slutsk. And I showed you the map, the difference of Slutsk to Kletsk. So they were not, Kletsk was on the border, the Polish border, and there was a nice Jewish community, a community that was willing to give facilities to the yeshiva. So it was decided that the yeshiva would move. And as I mentioned last class, getting across the border in those early years after the rise of communism, there wasn't yet an iron curtain. You could slip through. It was illegal to slip through, but you could hire smugglers. People went back and forth all the time. It wasn't an issue at all. And Kletsk was actually the nearest decent-sized city with from Kutsk, near the border. It was 70 kilometers from Kutsk, right over the border. So in 1921, Rivar and Cutler and 50 yeshiva students went, they took a carriage and then they walked from Slutsk across the border. Once they got across the border, however, they had to worry about the situation in Poland. For the most part, briberies could take care of that, but you had to have a passport, an illegal passport. So I should say illegal passport. They had to get a passport. That was done through bribery. And then you create a birthplace, however they did it. So Ravaron and the students were given passports, which meant that they were safe and they could not be thrown across the border back into the Soviet Union. However, many students remained in Slutsk together with Rav Isizal Meltzer. They still had the yeshiva there, or at least they can learn there. They couldn't learn, as I said, they didn't have the yeshiva, but they can learn in the shuls, although it was difficult, as we said, because you couldn't really give shiurim because that was illegal, but students remained there with Rav Zalman, and he was the rabbi. It's amazing how many people remained in the Soviet Union, and unfortunately, they remained until it was too late. Just like the people who remained in the early years, I see Heschel Raskus on with us from the important Raskus family. Many of you probably know the name from St. Louis. He was with us, Torah in Motion, last summer in Berlin, and when you're there, you hear about how before the Berlin Wall came up, there was East Germany and there was East Berlin and West Berlin, and anyone could leave East Berlin. There was no wall, there was nothing. And lots of people left. That's why they had to put up the wall. But there were plenty of people just figured, well, we can go tomorrow, we can go next week. And one day, all of a sudden, barbed wire goes up and then they start building a wall and people are then stuck. So it's always the case we're gonna see today, very unfortunate. Jews remaining behind in Eastern Europe when they could have left, people who had the ability to leave, and always assuming you can leave tomorrow, the next day, and that's exactly what happened with many, but not with Rav Isizal Meltzer, as we'll see. A few years later, Rav Isizal also comes. I'm not going to go into the details of that because many of you know that we had 6 or 7 classes on Rav Isizal Meltzer. What's important for our purposes, however, is that when Rav Zalman a few years later also illegally leaves the Soviet Union and comes to Kletsk, he is not involved in the yeshiva. It is now Rav Aaron Cutler's yeshiva with all the implications that we will see. As we know, they did not see eye to eye on everything, and I'll give you some evidence of this in a minute. And Kletsk is a Musar yeshiva. Rav Zalman, although Slutsk also had Musar, Rav Zalman was not himself a Musarite. Rav Aaron is a Musarite who would give Musar Shmuzin, and this is Rav Aaron's tradition coming out of Slobodka. The famous Rav Yecheskel Levenstein, who was famous for being in Mir, but he also was, earlier on, he was in Kletsk. He served as a Mashkiach at the yeshiva. The institution of the Mashkiach is an institution going back to Slobodka. It's a Musarite institution. It's not a supervisor of the kashrut of food. It's the supervisor, you could say, of the kashrut of the souls. And there were students who were interested in Musar and Slutsk, but there wasn't a Mashkiach Ruchani, as it's called. You could have people who could speak about Musar, but there wasn't an official position of a Mashkiach Ruchani. Now, it was during this time, the 1920s, that Rav Aaron Cutler begins his involvement in communal affairs. We will see that this involvement continues until the end of his life, often at odds with other rabbis. And in Europe, we'll see he's a minority position. In America, he's a minority as well, but because of his dominance, he's able to become the majority, I guess, perhaps we could say. Yeah. In 1923, he attends the first Knessia Gedola of the Aguda, which took place in Vienna. If you haven't seen the videos of the video of the Chafetz Chaim walking into there, I think there's now a video which even identifies the other rabbis. I encourage everyone to see that. It's one of the great discoveries in recent years about the history of Torah scholars, Torah sages. Most of his time, he wasn't involved in politics, obviously, but most of the time he wasn't giving shiurim as well. I shouldn't say that. Most of the time when he wasn't giving shiurim, he was involved in fundraising. He was raising money for the yeshiva. When we speak in terms of fundraising from the Russia yeshiva, it's not like today where yeshivas have people who do that for them. In those days, that was the job of the Rosh Yeshiva. They also had people. All the great yeshivas had offices in America, and they had people who would go over. But the Rosh Yeshiva also themselves personally went. And it's not like today, well, they'll go. They might go with Malkiel Cutler, will get on an airplane, a private jet, and I'll fly to Los Angeles to spend 2 days at a dinner there and meet with some wealthy machers. When they went for months. Even over a year, these Rosh Yeshiva, they would first go to England. Sometimes they would go to South Africa. Then they go to the United States. They'd spend 5-6 months in the United States traveling all over. Soon, Heschel, we're going to hear about St. Louis, Rav Aharon in St. Louis. Maybe you can know about this. Rav Aharon, though, is different in his involvement in the Aguda, because the other great Rosh Yeshiva, or most of the other great Rosh Yeshiva, didn't get involved in politics. They didn't want to get involved. The tradition, for instance, in Slobodka and other yeshivas as well, not all the yeshivas, we know Rabbi Chonah was involved, but that wasn't one of the great yeshivas, Baranovich. The other yeshivas, many of them refused to go to the Aguda convention, even if they agreed with Aguda, because they had to raise money from the entire Jewish community. And therefore, if they identified with, let's say, the Aguda, how could they then, it would be more difficult for them to raise money from Mizrahi types. The Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin also had this policy that the leadership of the institution would not take active roles in any of these organizations. In Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, it didn't apply to Hildesheimer, who was just the president, but the Rosh Yeshiva, they were not supposed to take such active involvement, although they did belong to, they did belong to the Aguda. Rav W.C. Hoffman, Rav Yechiel Weinberg did not. But in Slobodka, they had no involvement, and it makes sense. Now, regarding Rav Aharon's view of Zionism, we're going to see that he is a very harsh opponent of Zionism, really out of the mainstream of Lithuania, although he does appear to fall, he does fall in line when the other Gedolim make a decision, unlike Rav Chana Wasserman appears to have always remained on the outs. But just want to give you a story. I told the story with Rav Yisro Zalman, but it bears repeating as well. There's a man named, and we're gonna hear more about Rav Aharon and his attitude towards Zionism. But let me read you something from, there's a rabbi named, in Hebrew the name is pronounced Chiger, it's pronounced in English, it's written S-C-H-I-G-I-E-R. He ends up becoming a rabbi in South Africa, and he publishes his memoirs. And this is from the English. It's published in English and Hebrew. The title of the memoir is Slutsk, Johannesburg, Jerusalem. Although it really should read Slutsk, Kletsk, Jerusalem, Johannesburg, and then back to Jerusalem. He says as follows. By the end of 1924, it became known that Rabbi Meltzer had been appointed as Rosh Yeshiva in Yeshiva Eitz Chaim in Jerusalem. Remember that Rabbi Zalman comes to Kletsk, and then he goes to Jerusalem. And then he starts, Chigir writes that this got him thinking about going to Jerusalem, going to the land of Israel. And he started reading about Eretz Yisrael and Zionist ideals. Were beating in his heart. A few boys from Kletsk, not yeshiva boys, had gone there. And then he says, I dismissed the idea because it seemed an almost impossibility. The Eitz Chaim yeshiva wasn't a yeshiva which had people from Europe coming. Chevron yet wasn't there. I don't think it's there. I think it goes, someone can maybe check. I think it goes, when does it go? 22, if it goes in 22, it already have been there. So I don't know why he didn't consider 23. I forget what year Chevron, someone please look it up, what year Chevron moves there from Slobodka. But he doesn't mention that. He says, then he read in a newspaper that Rav Kook had become established a new yeshiva in Jerusalem. Not like the yeshivas of old, but a yeshiva who would follow his message of Eretz Yisrael. So then he decides that's the place. And then Rav Kook was looking for yeshiva students from outside the Eretz Yisrael, not from the old Yishuv. He wanted to bring them in, and he was going to give them certificates so they could go. So this Rabbi Chigier, I forget his first name, he decides he wants to go. So he says, Rav Yisrael Zalman's appointed Eitz Chaim, but he's still living in Kletsk. He hasn't gone there. So what does he do? He goes to Rabbi Meltzer, who's still there, and he says to him that I want to go to Rav Cook's yeshiva. And Rav Yisrael Zalman, quote, immediately agreed, possibly because he himself was Zionistically inclined, and he liked the plan. Remember, we saw with Rav Yisrael Zalman that he himself was really a Tzioni for an Agudist. He very much was a Zionist. I immediately wrote a letter to Rabbi Cook, to which Rabbi Meltzer added a few words of praise about me. And after 2 months of waiting, I received a reply that I had been accepted and an entry permit had been sent for me to the English consulate in Warsaw. Then he continues, when it became known that I intended to go to Palestine, Rabbi Cutler was furious. He called me and strongly scolded me for my venture. When he saw that I was adamant, he reminded me of my first act of disobedience and rebellion. He had another issue earlier. He simply told me that I had no place in his yeshiva anymore. This was a hard blow to me. Where would I go? Where would I find food to eat? In other words, he was kicked out of the yeshiva, and because he was kicked out of the yeshiva, he no longer got a stipend, and he couldn't afford to buy anything, any food even. But the Almighty had not forsaken me. When Rabbi Meltzer heard of this situation, he offered me to come to stay in his house until I could go to Eretz Yisrael. So here, Rav Aaron Cutler expels the yeshiva student for wanting to go to be a Zionist and go to Eretz Yisrael, and his own father, Rav Yisrael Zalman, who supported him going, says, well, you can't live in the yeshiva, come live with me and you can live here and eat here. He and his son, Tzvi Yehuda, later the founder of the yeshiva in Rehovot, that's Yeshiva HaDarom, were ready to leave shortly, so there would be plenty of room in his house where his wife and daughter would remain for the time being. A young couple, Rabbi Shach and his wife, would also stay there. And then he describes how Rav Shach later became very famous. Now that I was provided with board and lodging, I can manage without the allowance that Rabbi Cutler had withheld from me, and I could continue planning on how to get to Israel. So here you see really an extremist response for someone who wants to, I shouldn't say it's to go to Eretz Yisrael, because if he was going to go to the Eitz Chaim Yeshiva, I don't think the response would be that way. But it was the fact that he was going to go to, at least I think, that he was going to go to Rav Cook's new Zionist-inclined yeshiva, that this was the reaction, a really sharp reaction. So Rav Yisrael Zalman goes in 1925, I think it is. I have to look up. No one responded with Chevron, so I'll look it up. I'll look it up later. And we have a letter from him from 1925 in which he mentions that in Kletsk, where he had recently left, there were 150 students in the yeshiva and 50 students in what he calls the yeshiva katana. The yeshiva katana is, I guess today we would call it maybe a machina. Baranovich, Rav Yisrael Zalman's yeshiva was regarded as a yeshiva katana. That is, for younger guys, not 19, 20, 21, you know, maybe 15, 14, 15, 16, but who were not really ready to be in the yeshiva gedola. That is, they couldn't learn, let's say, on their own at the proper level. In fact, he explains in this letter, he says, the yeshiva katana is where boys who need help in learning. That means preparing a gemara. When you go to the great yeshiva, they would give you a Gemara. They would tell you, you know, prepare this daf with Rashi and Tosfos. And for guys who are not ready for that, they would be in the yeshiva katana. And that's really the difference. Yeshiva gedola, Rav Yisrael Zalman says, is where they could prepare on their own and do it all on their own. Really, in the yeshiva gedola, the Rebbe doesn't teach you. So you learn the sugya on your own, and then he just gives you his innovations and insights. And it's whereas in the yeshiva katana, he has to explain really what the pshat is in the sugya. The yeshiva katana was under the name of Rav Dov Kreutzer. As I recall, he's martyred in the Holocaust. But they did work together and they raised money and they helped each other out. Actually, no, Dov Kurtzer dies in America. He goes to America to raise money and he dies here. He comes in 1930. That's where he does. By the way, the yeshiva's name, Eitz Chaim. The yeshiva, the official name of the Kresk Yeshiva. I want to show you a picture here of Rav Aharon. You know, Rav Aharon also had to raise a lot of money, of course, and not just from yeshivish people, but he's living in Kletsk, he has to, you know, this is now an institution of the community, and he wants to raise money from the community. Here is a picture of him, I hope you can see it, with the community leaders. So some look religious, others look non-religious. We've spoken many times how there's this unfortunate misconception that in Europe, communities and people were basically all religious. It's not true at all. I'm not saying that all the people in this picture are not religious, just because they don't have, well, some are not wearing kippot. In Eastern Europe, that's a sign, generally. And in any city of any decent size, you had Bundists, you had Zionists. That's pretty standard. Well, there's another, this is from Sarovsky's book, page 100. On page 103, you have the famous sort of, they don't do this anymore as far as I know, although YU students did it as a joke a few years ago. In there, you have all the students and you have a picture of the Rebbeim, including a picture of Rav Shach, who was involved there. A Yeshiva University students about 5 years ago did one of these. And it says at the top, Misifta, you know, Rabasa, Eitz Chaim de Slutsk, which has now been moved to Kletsk, and this is from 1928. So when you think about the Lakewood Yeshiva today, it's not just Kletsk, it's really Slutsk. Rav Aharon, I mean, if you read his letters, and not just his letters, all the Rosh Yeshiva, they're constantly writing about how they have like no money, and you get the sense that they were just 1 or 2 months away from not having any money to buy food even. Fortunately, they would get money from the joint in America. They'd get money from Vada Yeshiva, not Vada Yeshivos, Rav Henkin's organization. I'm forgetting the name of Rav Henkin's organization. There was a Vada Yeshivos. No, there was a Vada Yeshivos in Europe, and the Vada Yeshivos would be sent money from America from the joint. But Rav Henkin, once he came to America, they also sent money. Mazelman's going to tell me, Ezra's Torah. Yeah, the Ezra's Torah would send money. Would send money to individuals, scholars. But then those days, it would send money to yeshivas. If you go to YU, you have the Vada Yeshivas archive there. Many letters from Chaim Moshe Brzezinski. It's constantly asking for money, and he distributed the money to the various yeshivas. So it was tough choices, because he had to determine which yeshivas would get more money. It depended on the population, how distinguished the yeshivas were. Rav Aharon decides he has to go to America. He had traveled already to raise money, but this was to be his first trip to America. The trip lasts 11 months. So there's a perfect example of how long these trips would sometimes take. And the idea was to go across the length and breadth of the land go to all and every city in America in those days, even where I am now, Scranton, little Scranton, had small communities, bigger cities had bigger communities of Yiddish-speaking Jews from Eastern Europe. And the idea was to hit all the decent cities. And when you went, you didn't just show up one day. You'd spend a week or two. You'd give drushas in every shul. You'd spend Shabbos or two and give drushas, and you'd have parlor meetings. It was constantly raising money. He arrives at the port, and he's met there by a delegation from Agudas Rabbanim. Agudas Rabbanim was the organization of great rabbis. Many of these people knew Rav Aharon from Sabaka, knew him from Lithuania, Poland. This was covered in all the Yiddish newspapers. It was covered in Hapardes. But the problem was, he comes to America and he's not the only person raising money. It's always hard to raise money when someone comes before you. If any of you listening right now who live in areas where a lot of mishalachim, it's a problem. Let me read you something from Sarovsky. On page 207, he quotes a letter from Rav Aharon that he says that, I'll just read the translation here. This, he says that, I said he came in 1935, so I'm reading now the end of 35, a letter written from Beis Nissan, so figure April or end of March, 1936, Toledo. He's in Toledo, Ohio, and he writes in it that in Columbus, Ohio, they raised $130. Someone have to pull up the inflation calculator. If you Google inflation calculator, you get a mechanism that'll show you, and you can plug in a number, and it'll tell you what it is in today's dollars. Now, this is a depression. It's hard to raise money, but $130, so I don't know what that is. And then he says, and last night, we came to Toledo here, and the rabbi, Harav Depo, the rabbi here, he learned with us in Slutsk, so he's going to help us raise money. Then he says that after being for a time in Toledo, we're off for Shabbos to Cleveland. He says we're supposed to go to Cleveland, but why not? He received a message that Sirim are Mislabotka, dignitaries. It doesn't mean the Rosh Yeshiva, it means important people from Slabotka. That is, Meshulachim from Slabotka, they had already arrived in Cleveland. So he can't go Shabbos in Cleveland because Cleveland, you know, it's all about Slabotka. Maybe the next week or the week after, give him a week to rest, you can have all about Kletsk. But you can't have a situation where you have two people, you know, in one. And by the way, this is for both of them. The Slabotka, even though they're first, if Rav Aharon then comes, then they're going to complain, and because it's going to hurt Slabotka, but it's in Rav Aharon's benefit also, because if he's there, then he can only raise half the amount of money because it's going to be divided. And so you want to have it. It's like when they have the schools, they have open houses. They try to make sure they don't have them on the same day. So then he says, so he can't go. He says that these people, Hikdimu, you know, they came first. So then so what about going to Detroit? He can't go to Detroit because, you know, he's going to Detroit. Hagon Rav Yechiel Michal Gordon, Rosh Yeshiva Lomja, Shekfar Hukba Avro Mikodem, and they already arranged with him. So in other words, he finds out right when he's about to go to Cleveland that the Slabotka people are already there. So he figures, well, I'll go to Detroit. He can't go to Detroit because he learns that they've already made arrangements for Rav Gordon, the Lomja Rosh Yeshiva. So what's he supposed to do? Then he says, Eini Yodea Dain Mekomenu Achag HaPesach. He doesn't know where he's going to be for Pesach. So that shows you the difficulty it was. Now, somewhere, I can't find it here, but somewhere in the book it talks about his time in St. Louis. Earlier it mentions that he was in, this is really not that important, but it mentions he was in New York staying with a Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Dachowitz. Just a European Rosh Yeshiva, not Rosh Yeshiva, European Rav who was here. The reason that name always, every time I see it, is important to me because somehow in my mother's family, my grandmother, she had these Hebrew books from her youth. I have a Shari Kshuva of Rabbeinu Yona and a couple others, and inside they have a stamp of the Tzvi Hirsch Dachowitz, which I gather was the shul that in Brownsville that her family went to when she was young. My grandmother's parents were kosher butchers. So somehow I got that book, and I don't know why she would have it if it had, maybe Rav Dachowitz got rid of it. But so it says that when he was with Rav Dachowitz, they made a declaration, an appeal in Shul, and the Gabayim, the Parnassim, announced that for $12, you could support a student for an entire month. So that's what he was doing, going around raising. Oh, here it is. I made a note for it, because not that I knew Heschel would be with us, but Heschel, your family's been in St. Louis forever. On page 208 in Soroski, it talks about how first he went to Atlanta, and then he writes from Atlanta that we were in St. Louis for 3 weeks. and the rabbis helped us as much as they could. And then he writes, he wants to know, how are things doing with the Avodah HaBrucha, the blessed work of the Ladies Auxiliary? I mean, that's written in Hebrew script. You know, have they put out all the things that they agreed that they were going to do? In other words, they got the ladies to get together to raise money for Kletsk. He says, you have to get all our sisters together so that the society will be Yesod, Vakiyum, Mitzara Torah. You know, you have to create this ladies' auxiliary society that it can raise money for us. So again, 3 weeks in St. Louis. Understand that when you would go to these places, you need to have to rest also. But that's what they would be doing. When he came to America in 1935, he also came with the Menahel, which I guess you translate as the director of the yeshiva. And at the same time that Rav Aaron was there, there was another person raising money for the Kletsk yeshiva. And when Rav Aaron goes back to Europe, he stays there. This person is someone who's already there. He's in the office. They had an office where full-time they'd raise money. Why you had this? Yeshiva Shribitz Yochanan used to have an office, and they would send people out just like this to raise money across all of America. Meshulachim. You always have to wonder how much, what was the percentage that the Meshulach took? You have to wonder that today as well. But in those days, we have various, Dine Torah and discussions where people, you know, they make claims, the Meshulachim claim that they're entitled to X amount of dollars. So we know, I mean, this was their living. They supported themselves as a Meshulach. So the overhead was a lot, I think you can say. But I don't know. And I don't know today what Meshulachim take. They take 30% of what they raise. They take 50%. Generally, I know that Federation, Jewish Federation, is for all the big charities, they have the best when it comes to overhead. More money goes, they always claim this, and it's true, more money goes for the actual tzedakah that Federation raises across the country than for overhead. When you look at some of these organizations, United Way, things like that, I mean, it was scandalous when the figures came out that like 80% some of these organizations of their money was overhead. They were of every dollar they raised, 80 cents went to pay salaries and things like that. That's clearly outrageous. But so I don't know what the overhead was in those days. I'll get to the comments in 10 minutes. While in the United States, and maybe this is why he felt the need to spend 11 months, because when Rav Kook came with Avraham Shapira and Moshe Mordechai Epstein, I think they were only here 5 months, if I'm not mistaken. But he was doing something else. He was teaching Torah. He spoke. He gave a shiur at Yeshiva Shribitz Lachanan. Not only did he give a shiur at Shribitz Lachanan, the old librarian there, Zalman Alpert, showed me he used the books. There was in those days they had they didn't have a stamp. Let me correct what I'm saying. When you took out books, if you've ever been to YU and you see very old books from the library. Remember like the old ones that you take out the card and you'd stamp it? In the olden days, they wouldn't stamp it. They'd write the name of it. And Zalman Alpert, some of you, any YU people remember him, found, I'm not sure if it was one or two books, but he definitely showed me one of them. And this was from Rav Aaron Cutler, although it might have been from 1940 or 41 when he came back, but it had a card with Rav Aaron Cutler's name. So Rav Aaron Cutler had taken out at least one book from Yeshiva Shribitz Lachanan. Rav Yochanan Wasserman, if you recall, refused to go to Yeshiva College, give a shiur, but Rav Aaron did. But while there, he also encouraged people to open yeshivos, and for the students who were high quality, he encouraged them to go back to study in Lithuania. That's how Rav Gedalia Shor ended up leaving Torah Vadasa in 1938 and going to Kletsk. Because he had been impacted by the visit of Rav Aaron and the discussions, the importance of being exiling yourself to a place of just Torah. In those days, the people in these yeshivas also went to university. So Rav Aaron focused a lot about how it's important to come to Lithuania where Torah is dominant and you don't have to worry about secular education. And that impacted, as I said, Rav Gedalia Shor. Rav Gedalia Shor would remain there until shortly before the war. I'll get back to that, because Rav Gedalia Shor would go against Rav Aaron Cutler and return to America. We're going to see that Rav Aaron Cutler, what are you going to say? No one's a prophet. His judgment on this matter with the coming of the war was completely incorrect. And well, we'll get to that. This led to a big issue with him and Zorach of Arhaftig. I don't think we're going to get to it this class, but we'll get to it definitely next class. While in America, Rav Aaron Cutler encouraged Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, or he was known as Mr. Mendelowitz. Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, important figure, very much involved in the day school movement. Someone commented, if you recall last week, I said that the three most important figures in American Orthodoxy after the war are Rav Aaron Cutler, Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Lubavitch Rebbe. Someone said, what about Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz? He was so important in terms of Torah Masora. I don't know. I said that if you didn't have a Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz, I don't know. Would things have developed that differently? He maybe would have taken a little longer. Rav Shraga Feivel did other things. I'm sitting right now in Scranton. He was a rabbi here in Scranton. And then he, in Torah Vadas, they called it Torah Vadas, as we spoke in previous classes, because originally he was supposed to have secular education, be open to secular education. Mizrahi people founded it together with Shraga Feivel Mendelowitz. But Rav Aaron encouraged Rav Shraga Feivel, who always wanted to be called Mr. Mendelowitz, to open a yeshiva which would not have secular studies. Torah Vadas, which was his yeshiva, they had secular studies in the high school, obviously, and the students were encouraged to go to university later. And Shraga Feivel, he was worried that if I open up a new yeshiva here, which is just going to be a yeshiva with Torah study, this is going to hurt Torah Vadas. And that's my yeshiva. So what Rav Aaron writes to him as follows. This, you can find the letter in Sarovsky, page 211 to 212. I mean, some of these letters, I have them from other sources as well. There's a book, Udi Meyesh, which has, there's other books I have, but they're very conveniently, they're found right here in Sarovsky. Rav Aaron writes to him that it's not going to affect Torah Vadas. That which you have a chash, hefsed on the sifta, you're worried that it's going to cause damage to the sifta. Rav Aaron says it's not a damage. Why? Because many, including from, he says, the mitzuyonim, the most excellent, will not want to hakdish atzmam rak b'torah b'loshum l'mud echol. He says to him, don't worry, because most people in America, even among the elite Torah scholars, they're not going to want to devote themselves just to Torah study. They're still going to want go to have secular studies. So Torah Vadas is still going to have a very big niche to fill, because most people are not going to want to, and most parents, as he says later in another, I think it's another letter, are not going to want to send their kids to a place where there's only Torah study. So don't worry about that. You can open up a branch which is just going to be Torah study, and it's not going to affect the main yeshiva. It reminds me, a few years ago, Herschel Schechter gave an interview to The Commentator. That's the YU newspaper. And he said, I don't know why we have to, fight. We're having this problem. We're losing some students, the more right-wing students. We're losing them to Lander College. And this was after a couple of the Rosh Yeshiva left. And he says, and what about the students who choose Lander College instead of coming to YU? He says, we should open up a branch, Yeshiva College, which is like Lander College, doesn't really have the humanities, is just focused on professional education, pre-professional. You can get an accounting degree, and it would be like Lander College. Torah uparnasa, that's the phrase of Lander College, Torah and making a living, as opposed to Torah umada. And that was his suggestion. And of course, that would never happen. It's Yeshiva University is a university. They're not going to create a place which is a pre-professional school. But there were some people who said we could never do this because this would hurt YU. And I think Rav Schechter is right. It wouldn't hurt YU, because most people are going to YU would still go to YU. It would only be those people who are going to something like Lander. Then they could, those people then would feel comfortable going to YU because they wouldn't have to have a whole humanities education. And many of them are not prepared for that because they haven't been to decent schools of secular education. They've been to more Haredi schools, so they're not ready for that. So Rav Schachter said, so we'll keep the regular college where the same people go to it would still go to it, and we'll open up a branch, like a frum branch, and they'll still have the same shiurim, the same Rosh Yeshiva, but now obviously that's a non-starter because it would defeat the whole purpose of what the university is, why it would defeat the whole purpose of what YU stands for, of the best of secular education. But I have to say that the other argument against Rav Schachter is wrong, and Rav Schachter was completely right. It wouldn't have hurt Yeshiva University per se. It just would have maybe hurt the brand of YU because people would say, would look down on it because of the professional school, as they would call it. Now, this idea did not come to fruition at that time. It would come to fruition later when Rav Shraga Feivel established the base Medrash Elyon in Muncie, something we mentioned in the past. Getting back, well, I'll talk for 3 or 4 more minutes. And then I'll take the questions. Rav Avner returns to Kletsk. So let's speak a little bit about Kletsk. And we're moving into that time. We're not going to get to this class, the very difficult era of World War II. We'll definitely get to it next class. It's a problem, as we'll see, because no answer is the right answer. Except in retrospect. In retrospect, we all know what the right answer is. But at the time, it wasn't so clear, it wasn't so obvious. So we'll have to try to avoid being Monday morning quarterbacks. Because from our perspective, this whole idea today, looking at it, raising money for a yeshiva in Poland in 1935 and 36 and 37, 38, 39, and even in 1940 and raising it when it's in Lithuania, I mean, the whole idea is crazy. In retrospect, of course, they should have immediately gotten out of there, moved to Eretz Yisrael, and they could have. They could have arranged certificates for them, as we'll see. The whole yeshiva could have gone. The yeshiva could have gone to America. Agudas Rabbanim wanted to bring it. All this could have been done. There was always exceptions to the quotas for university, for scholarship, for, you know, the yeshiva students were treated like university students. They could have transferred the yeshiva in the 1930s. But who could have, no one's a prophet and no one imagined. And to come to America where, you know, so much irreligiosity, yes, there was irreligiosity in Poland, but there was a sense that as long as you remained in the yeshiva and it wasn't so sophisticated like America, you were safe. In Israel, if you went to Eretz Yisrael, there was the fear of Zionism. But we'll get to that next week. Let me just continue for a few minutes in Kletsk. Rav Aaron was involved also, not just in the yeshiva, but outside the yeshiva, in Kletsk. He helped establish a cheder, and a Talmud Torah, and a Beis Yaakov. First of all, he needs these for his own children and the children of the Rebbein there, but he also was concerned about the community. And not just because the community would send kids to his yeshiva. Rav Aaron, his whole life, was involved in Klal Yisrael, in affecting Judaism as a whole. And that's obviously a good thing, but it will have negative aspects because that helps create such the machokas when he comes to America, unlike other Rosh Yeshiva who are content to remain in their yeshiva and influence their yeshiva. Rav Aaron wanted to influence the entirety of America. And that would bring him into machokas with the more liberal rabbis. We're told that when parents took their children out of the cheder and sent them to the Tarbut school or the other non-religious schools or the quasi-religious schools, Rav Aaron would personally go to see them and try to convince them not to do that. There were Yiddish schools, there were Zionist schools, and some of these Zionist schools were not anti-religious. You could have Mizrahi types going there. You had a Tarbut school. Rav Aaron was so negative about the Tarbut Zionist schools that it turned the Zionist leaders against him. And they tried to make problems for the yeshiva. And they could make problems because if you had students there who didn't have the passports, they didn't get bribed and get those passports, then they're there illegally. And it creates a difficult situation. Rav Aaron, and this might surprise anyone from Lakewood when you hear this, knowing Rav Aaron's reputation, Rav Aaron also helped in the establishment of the Yavna School for Boys. The Yavna School for Boys is something I've written about. I had a whole blog post about this. It's not something you'd expect from Rav Aaron, simply because the Yavna School is a school that has secular studies. It was a school, I guess it's from Lithuania. It's you call it a modern Orthodox school. The head of it was the head of the whole Yavna system was the Kovno Rav. And we have a very nice article by a scholar Mordechai Zalkin in Israel about the Yavna school system. And I'm assuming it depended, you know, each different cities could be more liberal than others. For example, in Telz, it was quite liberal. But we know that Ivrit was used in the Yavna school system. They taught secular studies. It was a school system for the Balabatim. What we see from this is that even Rav Aaron did not have a perspective that everyone is going to go to yeshiva, which was unimaginable, impossible. A couple hundred people were in his yeshiva. Every town, you might have one or two who go off to yeshiva. You're dealing with 99% of the population. And especially then, when people wanted to send their kids, it wasn't like they go to cheder to 12 or 13 and then become an apprentice. Parents wanted to send their kids to get degrees. And you had the creation of a middle class in Lithuania. And you had the creation of a like a modern Orthodox laity. That is, people who were getting secular degrees and were working as Dov Zakheim, by the way. You know Dov Zakheim? His father was a lawyer and was the legal advisor to Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski, and also a rabbi. So because of this, because the rabbis did not want the children who were not going to become rabbanim, not going to go to, in those days, there wasn't a concept, everyone goes to yeshiva. You went to yeshiva, you became a rabbi. If you weren't going to become a rabbi, you didn't go to yeshiva. They said it was vital to create a school system like we have in America, a day school system for those who are not going to become rabbis. And Rav Aaron himself helps in the establishment in Kletsk of a Yavna school system. In general, this impression people have of Rav Aaron is a wrong one. Yes, he believed that everyone should go to Yeshiva Gedola, but if you're not going to go to Yeshiva Gedola, you're supposed to go to public school, you're supposed to go to Tarbot school. In America, Torah Masora was involved. Yes, Rav Aaron thought, and Rav Moshe, and all them thought that boys and girls should be separate, and they thought that Torah studies should be in the morning, secular studies in the afternoon, all these things. But if you couldn't get it, if the only choice was something else, of course that's better than the alternative. And you had all these people from Lakewood and other places, followers who went to the, had day schools, and they slowly, they tried to make them more amenable, you could say. Let me end here. Let me give you a story I heard. I've been doing a lot of, thank God, a lot of Shabbases. Recently, I was at a shul and I heard this story, and it just reminded me because what I said, that just because institutes were not what Rav Aaron wanted or Rav Moshe doesn't mean they banned them or anything. No, they were, that's the best we could do. So we'll work with the best we could do till it can be better. I was at a shul recently that the mechitza wasn't so high. It's a little higher now than it used to be, but still it's not so high. And they were looking for a rabbi. I'll tell anyone who's interested offline what shul I'm speaking about. I don't know if the president told me the story. I don't know if he wants it made public for the whole world, because although we might have a small group listening to us live, many, many more people, 10 times as many who listen live, listen not live. And two people I know, I even met someone a few weeks ago, they've listened to every single class. Okay, so the story was as follows. They're looking for a new rabbi, and they had someone come from MTJ. And the rabbi, I don't know if they liked him or not, whatever, but he told them that he was a serious contender. He was interviewing there, and he said that he has a problem, though. He doesn't think he could become their rabbi, because I guess they did like him, because they got to that stage, because he's not the rabbi now, I can tell you that, because the mechitz is not big enough. He comes from MTJ, follower of Moshe Feinstein, or Moshe Feinstein says he needs a bigger mechitza. And they said that, you know, they were upset with this, so they asked him to ask for David Feinstein. This is after Moshe Feinstein passed away, but he still considered himself as bound to what Moshe Feinstein held as the height of the mechitza. So Rav David Feinstein came to the shul and he looked at the mechitza and he said, it's 100% okay mechitza. The previous rabbi was a Talmud Chacham. He's a student of Rav Soloveitchik. Rav Soloveitchik held, it's an okay mechitza. There's no problem davening here. If they do choose you as the rabbi, then since you follow, we have a more strict position, then you should see what you can do to make it larger. So he was saying that you can take the position as a rabbi and see if you can make it a larger mechitza. But the implication of the rabbi's comment earlier was, he says he doesn't know if he could be in the shul, because the mechitza, the implication was that Rav Moshe says the mechitza has to be a certain height. Therefore, if you find a shul that the mechitza is not that height, you can't daven in that mechitza. And that's not, Rav David says absolutely not, that, Rav Soloveitchik said it's an okay mechitza, so anyone could daven here. But if you're going to be the rabbi here, then you should try to put your own approach as to the height of the mechitza in. Okay, let me look back at the questions and comments. One other thing we're going to do next class, we're going to revisit the Marian Bad Aguda convention. We spent a lot of time on this with Rabbi Chanan Wasserman. You might recall that I said that Aaron Cutler was on Rabbi Chanan's side. So that was the convention where the Aguda finally agreed that it can support a Jewish state, and we will see Rabbi Aaron still refused to accept. He accept after the fact, he would accept what they said, but he argues in Marian Bad even in 1937 against the Jewish state. So we'll get back to that next class. But let me look at some of the questions. Meiselman says, maybe it had to do with the religious garb of the East European religious leaders. I forget exactly what you were commenting on. Moshe from Lakewood says he has a minhag to put matzah in the soup against gebrachts. I don't know why you would have a minhag Dafka to do that. I don't think there's any fear of matzah balls going out. The problem with peanuts is that since it's a raw peanuts, you could take, I gave the suggestion that everyone should bring raw peanuts to the Seder table and distribute them so that everyone knows that, you know, we eat peanuts. But the problem is, if in terms of everything packaged and processed, if the OU decides that now they're no longer going to do peanut oil, because some people don't hold up peanuts, then no one's going to be able to get, and the OK doesn't, et cetera, no one's going to be able to get kosher Pesach items with peanuts. So willy-nilly, to use Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous term, we all end up adopting the practice, the minhag maybe, maybe it'll become a minhag after two generations, of not eating peanuts. But I haven't heard that any Litvaks have gone anti-Gebrachts. Maybe they have, but I haven't heard that that's a new Frumkeit. Moshe from Lakewood says, the Gemara says that they stood up for everything until the time of the Tanaim. Now, Moshe, you're very upset with the standing up, but, you know, it's the, today we read the whole Torah, and we do all the davening. It's clear that we don't, I know you heard all these answers, I'm just saying for everyone else, it's clear that we don't, even if we stand up for the Ten Commandments, we're not saying that that's, special, the most valuable, the most sanctity. Last class I said the common interpretation of the Rambam saying it's the most important is incorrect. But in any event, the most sanctity, it's Chida already gives a justification for standing up. And at the end of the day, do we have those sort of minim around? So someone wrote to me, well, maybe the reformers, I suggested this, maybe the reformers would be categorized, because don't they say that we don't eat kosher and we don't do that, but the Ten Commandments, you know, that's important, that we do. Maybe you'll want to say that, but, you know, we've had hundreds of years now of people standing up for the Ten Commandments, and it hasn't led to any real heresy. But okay, you can stand at it from the beginning if you want. Because Meisman says that the New York Times headline, he says that they weren't sages. Where is it? I have it here. The headline. Headline is something like they were sages, not saints. I guess what saints, that's really what, remember what the altar was saying. He says, I never said he's a tzaddik. I never said, so if saint means chafetz chayim, Okay, they weren't all saints. Okay, let me take back what I said. I guess they weren't all saints. If saints means Chofetz Chaim, Kamenetsky has plenty of stories of how the rabbis got angry at one another, they screamed at one another. They're human too. So if that's what you're going to say, okay. So, it's a provocative heading. Moshe says to Rabbi Raskus, who I can't communicate with directly due to technical issues. Yes, it used to be that you could, we have to fix this, tech support, we need to fix this, that you could send private comments to people who are listening. There's this gadget, you just press the button, press their name, and then you can send a private comment. But Moshe is telling Heschel that he is the great-grandson of Pesha Chaya Pupko, which is Rivka Raskus' sister. So I guess Moshe from Lakewood and Heschel are related. Correct me if I'm wrong, Moshe, that means you're in the Chofetz Chaim's family, Pupko? Moshe from Lakewood, you can get, there's his email. Okay, I didn't even see it. Meiselman says their stores are of Aharon in London and making of a Gadol. Yeah, Rav Aharon would, London was an easy trip because London was full of East European Jews in London, in Leeds, in Manchester. It was very easy. So all the Rosh Yeshiva went there. And I don't know if there's still an Ezra's Torah. What I can say about Ezra's Torah is that Rabbi Yehuda Herzl Henkin writes in one place that after his grandfather died, it wasn't the same Ezra's Torah. And he says that they spent money on things they should have spent money on. I think he says fancy offices. If you know how Rav Henkin lived, he lived like a pauper from Ezra's Torah. I don't know about Rav Dachowitz. I didn't investigate it really. Moshe, you say, did he stay by Rav Chaim Fischel Epstein in St. Louis? It could be. Soraski doesn't mention it. It's easy to find it out. If you go to Hapardes, back for those years, and the other and papers, which are now many of them are online, they cover these journeys. Last semester, Heschel, we spoke about Chaim Fischel Epstein because he has an important, he was a recipient of a responsum, and he was involved in a dispute about civil marriages. He's one of the first, if not, I think he's the first great posek in America to say that a civil marriage doesn't need a get. So there was, with Rav Issachar Zalman Meltzer, we dealt with this. What else can we say? Anything else I need to... What's the similarities between Rav Aharon's anti-Zionism and the Brisker Rav? Let's wait till next class, because next class we'll see what Rav Aharon says at the Marienbad convention. I mean, there is going to be, just to anticipate, there's going to be a big difference in that after the Gedolim, the Moetzes Gedolei Torah rules against Rav Aharon's approach, and especially after the state is declared and the Moetzes Gedolei Torah rules that Aguda should recognize the state and be part of the government. This then leads to the great break, where the extremists break from the Aguda, the ones who hadn't already broken and formed the Turei Karta, and the Brisker Rav never accepts the State of Israel. So the Brisker Rav has to be regarded as an anti-Zionist. Rav Aharon is a non-Zionist. That is, they accept a state, they work with it, they work within the state, just like, you know, when the Eda Haredi challenged Itcha Meir Levin, the son of the Ger Rebbe, how could he be in this, Knesset with all these heretics? He says, I sat in the Polish parliament. If I could sit in the Polish parliament, certainly I could sit in the parliament with Jews. So they never could understand. The Agudists, the Agudistan could never understand, once the state was declared, how you could be anti the state, because that's the state. You could oppose it, but now you're part of it. So it's a different... practically, you have to work within the state. Meiselman says, and this is a question that it's not to me, it's really Moshe from Lakewood. Why would we have standard shul decoration to have the luchos on the parochas, the Ten Commandments, or on the Ark? According to the Rambam's position, you shouldn't. And yet we see Minhag Yisrael is. So Moshe says, oh, Moshe says, you're right, you shouldn't. According to the Rambam, according to Rav Avadia, you wouldn't, I guess. Okay, two more questions. Meiselman says, isn't the family of Aram Pinsker Balkan also of Chaim Grada's fame? I don't think so. I don't recall. I mean, we didn't speak about Rav Aaron Pinsk, Aaron Walken of Pinsk in this class, but I don't recall any mention of the Walkens in. Of Chaim Grada fame. Okay. Everyone, thank you very much. Oh, Marion Walken. Okay. Rav Aaron Walken, let me say one more thing before I get off about Rav Aaron. Aaron Walken was the rabbi of Pinsk. He's martyred in the Holocaust. His son survives as a rabbi in New York. His son actually was the Mashgiach on Zim shipping lines. I know that, but his son survives. Rav Aaron Walken should be remembered because he wrote the first responsum against the bat mitzvah. There's a rabbi in Israel named Ari Enkin. He emailed me wanting to know about Rav Aaron Walken because Rav Aaron Walken, he's a Litvisher Rav, he writes, says about whoever has a bat mitzvah, whoever approves of it, you have the status of a zakein mamre, a rebellious elder. It's the worst thing you could say about a rabbi. Basically, you're out of the community. So Rabbi Enkin wanted to know, is he some sort of extremist, kanai? But he's not at all. But in 1930, whatever, whenever he wrote that responsum, bat mitzvah is not the same like we have today. It was clearly something that was coming from the non-Orthodox. But he's a very moderate person, and he was a rabbi for a short time in Pilvashuk, Rabbi Chaya of Weinberg City. And most important, remember this, his son was supposed to marry Rav Kook's daughter. I wrote about this once. They even had an announcement in the Hebrew papers, and then the shidduch was broken. Why the shidduch was broken, was that you, Moshe, who called it to my attention? Someone who reads my posts called that to my attention. They found it in the newspapers. Thank you all tonight. Send me the questions and comments. I'll pick up on them next week. Next week, we continue with Rav Aaron Cutler, and good night to everyone. Moshe, you sent it to me? Oh, no, you sent it. That's what's okay. Well, we'll continue. Moshe, if you sent me the Rav Aaron Walken, email me. I'm signing off now. Good night, everyone.